Blog Talk Radio.
Sounds of the Living Water Radio Show. Sounds of the Living Water. Sounds of the Living Water. Sounds of the Living Water Radio Show.
We teach the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. Preach the gospel unto the scattered nations. So many people are lost, it's time to be awakened. Come out of this world, it's ran by Satan. Through the Most High's laws, flee from things pagan. Understanding the word of Yah is really breathtaking. Under His love and covering is so amazing. Thank you each day, so now let's praise Him. Do things in unity, you and me. You wanna know what we talking about? Come and see. It's time to be deeply rooted up like a tree. You want the truth, it will set you free.
Sounds of the living water. Sounds of the living water, sounds of the living water, radio show. Sounds of the living water, sounds of the living water, sounds of the living water, radio show. Sounds of the living water, sounds of the living water, sounds of the living water, radio show. Sounds of the living water, sounds of the living water. Sounds of the Living Water Radio Show.
Good afternoon. This is Rob Christensen with another episode of Visible Secrets, Invisible Power, Climate Engineering in the Bible, and all the dots we can connect to this topic. Today, of course, with all the news on bacterial warfare, whatever you want to call it, the spread of the pandemic, everybody knows about it. But what's unclear to the population so often, thanks to media, is the cause. Is it just a snake? Is it some bats? It seems nature is always to blame for something. Or is it the glaciers that are melting that have dangerous virus or bacteria in them that might threaten us all? You know, how much fake can we tolerate before we come to our senses? But at the same time, it's one must understand that the road to reality is less traveled, including myself. I have to admit many times I've been mistaken and I've had to readjust what reality is based on new facts, new evidence. So, for example, with Julian Assange, I remember just despising, you know, during 2016, the impact he had on elections and so forth. But now in looking back, I've gone almost 180 degrees in the opposite direction, because what he did expose is cold-blooded murder of the empire. And, you know, on video. So he becomes the victim. He becomes tortured. They paid, what, $1 billion to get him in jail to another country that gave him refuge temporarily. So I can't help but express some anger, you know, with the way things are happening. And I'll just begin by just reviewing a little bit about past blogs, tipping the tables. A couple blogs ago, it's about direct physical action to bring about justice. And of course, that's Jesus tipping over the tables of the merchants selling animals and things at the synagogue in a sacred place. In the last blog, Women and Men, Sounders of the Alarm, it's, you know, through voice and mobility, horses, that was the means to awaken the public to their battle for justice against the British Empire. And of course, the United States Empire is not the only empire. All empires in general are due to fall. So presently, the battle for justice against all empires, mostly that of our own, United States military-industrial complex, takes on another mode of action. Whether by video or internet, photos, facts can be printed on paper, just as I am to vote today. Well, that was a couple weeks ago, but, you know, I voted in a primary, and it's got paper ballots. because as we all know, on electronics, it can get skewed. But on paper, it's verifiable. So that's my topic today, paper trails of the whistleblowers and the Tuskegee experiment. All are needed in this prophetic battle to salvage what we can of this dying planet. I will feature whistleblower William Carter Jenkins for his efforts to expose the African-American. Well, what I meant to say is William Carter Jenkins is of African-American lineage, and he was basically the first one to blow the whistle on the Tuskegee experiment. He passed away a year ago, and that will lead to Peter Buxton, whose whistleblowing efforts did successfully close this forever-long experiment. And on Wikipedia, again, thanks to Brother Job for bringing this Tuskegee syphilis experiment for background before I introduce the COVID-19 update as to what I understand facts to be. The Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, as it was written at the time, was a clinical study conducted between 1932 and 1972 by the U.S. Public Health Service. The purpose of the study was to observe the natural history of untreated syphilis. The African-American men in the study were only told they were receiving free health care from the United States government. So again, clinical insanity from long ago and continuing for how long? And then finally, I will continue to our present-day crisis of COVID, as I've said, in the paper trail that proves COVID-19 is a man-made designer virus bioweapon created with international cooperation among the criminally insane power structure of the pharmaceutical industrial complex. Dr. Francis Boyle was the author of Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989. And by the way, that act was passed unanimously with bipartisan support. Dr. Boyle at this time is censored from the media, other than alternative media, because of his revelations about truth and facts of the existence of biowarfare. He's been always monitoring and sharing what he has found in paper trails. These are written documents that describe the warfare research going on that was outlawed by his terrorism act. He's shown the detailed paper trail of publications proving that COVID is part and parcel work originating out of biolabs from locations around the globe. So, in addition, I have some scripture readings that pertain to this whistleblower blog, and I'll share them when I can, maybe in between. But I wanted to get right to a little bit more information about Mr. Jenkins and his contribution. And just give me a moment here to find. I have several internet publications on hand on my screen. And pardon if I'm a little unorganized, I had to run today for a family emergency. So I will find it in moments here, because I want to be sure to be accurate. But if I can't find it, I know enough about, okay. Well, let me put it this way. Dr. Jenkins was a statistician for the government, and he found publications that described this Tuskegee experiment. And, of course, he was deeply disturbed because he realized, as described, this was a total lie, a total, betrayal to innocent people, 360 sharecropper people, I believe, that were told they had syphilis symptoms, I understand, but they were told they had bad blood by the health department of those times, so that they were given government backing to take part in an experiment where they would be reimbursed, they would be housed, they'd be given a burial plot, and so forth. And what Mr. Jenkins, William Jenkins, noticed was that among the publications that indeed this was a total fabrication, that these people could be treated. And this was in the 60s. So again, it ended in 72. So what he did was he wrote an article about this, and it was well written. He presented it to different doctors. One of the doctors, his supervisor, who he delivered it to, was actually part of this experiment. So, of course, he wasn't going to do anything about it. And the shameful fact is that the other colleagues that he shared his article to did nothing. And, you know, how criminal, because the facts were there about this massive injustice. And so in the end, that article never did get published because it didn't have the references that were needed for the journal. But again, no backing from society, just all alone writing that. So he felt pretty miserable about the fact that it didn't get published. This inspired him to go on and become an epidemiologist, you know, a professional. He worked on civil rights issues. So he spent his life from, you know, being a young man, probably in high school, to work for social justice and progress. So again, he died just a year ago, and I wanted to make sure that, again, whistleblowers, that's what the topic is about today. He was the first whistleblower for this Tuskegee experiment. Now, the other person that ended it, this, Peter Buxton, he was, again, in the medical health field. And I saw a tape video with an interview from him. I only got partway through, but it was enough to understand how he came about with this. And it was by accident. He was at a restaurant, and he overheard that this doctor was being reprimanded by a government official, another doctor. You know, he overheard the conversation, and it was such that one of the subjects to the experiment, one of the sharecropper people, let's say, was complaining, you know, of these symptoms that were worsening. So the doctor did what any doctor should do. He treated him for the syphilis with I'll think of it. But you know, the treatment was there all along. Penicillin, that's the word I was looking for. He gave him penicillin, and the man healed. So this doctor, by his supervisor, was roundly scolded for wrecking the experiment, or, you know, not following the experiment. So, you know, it's an absolute murderer in many cases for years. This kind of murderous experiment was tolerated by so many in society. And obviously in white culture, you know, a racist, you know, circumstance by all means. But again, I am reminded, as far as racism, of a museum science exhibit that I've been to at the Minnesota Science Museum, that color of the skin, unfortunately, is what we judge by, but we forget our commonality in our genetics. In other words, a pygmy person who's short and dark-skinned or whatever can have more in common with, say, a Swedish person than, you know, say a Russian person does to the Swedish person. In other words, we're all mixed. And so you can't, it's just patently unfair to think that skin color can be used against people when we're basically all mixed genetically. You know, there's so much interbreeding that there's just no way over history that it's black and white, red and yellow, or whatever. There's no pure way to distinguish between the human species. So I'll leave it at that. But I did want to get to a little bit about the biblical background, so maybe I can find it this time. So bear with me for a second. So serious whistleblowing in the Bible. They cite Chronicles 20:33-21, Samuel 2:1-16, and I won't go into this because basically these Old Testament whistleblowers were ones that, so for example, if a king was evil, the servants killed the king. You know, they were all, in a way, the whistleblowers were ones that killed those who were so-called evil. So the author of this whistleblowing article, Martin Labar, is saying, well, besides the earthly consequences of assassinating a ruler, the Bible's Ten Commandments include a prohibition against murder. Are there occasions when, in spite of this assassination, a ruler is justified? And when there is no recourse to a body like the Congress to remove a powerful, corrupt leader? I'm not sure. I'm hopeful. I'm sure that I hope I am never part of any such plot as either a conspirator or the intended victim. I hope that if God clearly directed me to assassinate a president, I would do so. But it is extremely unlikely that he would do so. God tells us that our rulers are ordained by God, at least as a general principle, and perhaps always. Interesting that he cites Romans 13:1-7. And that's one that basically where Paul is traveling toward Spain, he crosses through his Rome, Italy, to write and speak to the Romans, because at the time there was struggles between the Romans and the early Christians. So he was trying to placate, and with good intentions, to bridge the gap between this divide that all under God, if you believe in God, are okay. So the assumption by Paul in this letter is that indeed, you know, we have to elect leaders, and as we're in a society that worships the one God, those leaders need to be feared because they were more or less selected as good people by, you know, the people of that time. But as I can see in this article, there's kind of a loophole here. He says, God, at least as a general principle. Well, what if that principle is broken, you know, even by a government? So I challenge Romans 13:1-7 that it must be understood by the context in which it was written. And that is the Apostle Paul trying to placate the Jewish and the Christian factions at the time. I thought that was kind of interesting. But I'll get to more of the whistleblowing here. I'll take that off. And I guess the best whistleblower, if you look at it, according to Joseph Gillespie, is Jesus was a whistleblower. Again, he tipped the tables for justice as a direct action. But traditionally understood, a whistleblower is a person acting written or within an organization who reports that organization's misconduct. An internal whistleblower is one who reports misconduct to another person within the organization. An external whistleblower reports misconduct to a person outside the organization, such as the media or law enforcement. With a certain amount of poetic license, the metaphor whistleblower can be added to Jesus' job description of Savior and Redeemer. And just to keep the historic record straight, there are no scriptural references to Jesus playing a tiny flute. I guess they're kind of making a joke about blowing a whistle. But anyways, without fear or of recrimination or protection, Jesus publicly and privately exposed the hypocritical religious leaders of his time and publicly challenged institutional laws that marginalized and bullied the widows and orphans, which were called the Anawim of this culture. The Hebrew word Anawim is found in the scriptures, the Old Testament, and literally means bowed down. This metaphorical image captured the very heart of Jesus' ministry of liberation. In the words of the prophet Isaiah, the Messiah's mission would be to bring good news to the poor, proclaim release to the captives, give sight to the blind, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. So in the traditional understanding of the law, which was the Torah, God's law consists of 613 applications on how to live and regulate one's life, according to the Torah. The traditional Ten Commandments were lost in the failure to distinguish them as the most important moral guidepost. Jesus' confrontation with the Pharisees and scribes was often around their inability to budge in the rigorous application of the minor laws on the normal lives of individuals. The watchdogs, who obsessively guarded the demands of the Sabbath, repeatedly cited Jesus and his disciples for failing to comply with the law. So, in one triumphal confrontation with the religious leaders, Jesus vented his frustration when the Pharisees accused his disciples of unlawful behavior, picking and eating grain on the Sabbath. Infuriated with the watchdogs, Jesus, the whistleblower, uttered a revolutionary interpretation of the law. The Sabbath was made for human beings and not human beings for Sabbath. Mark 2:27. So complicated by a failure to distinguish what was morally important from what constituted moral minutiae, the religious leaders were blinded by their smug attempts to suppress and control the ordinary people through inappropriate applications of the Torah. At one point, Jesus lashed out at their literal and strict interpretations. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. Matthew 23:4. So are you getting a picture of Jesus as a whistleblower? As we explore the gospel reading, Luke 4:21-30, for the fourth Sunday in ordinary time, Jesus is almost killed in his hometown of Nazareth when he finished a reading from the prophet Isaiah and proclaimed that he was really the fulfillment of the messianic prophecy. The people in the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up and drove Jesus out of town and led him to the brow of a hill and were going to hurl him off. But Jesus passed through their midst and went on his way. Jesus' truth-telling was not easy to swallow by both the locals who doubted his claim, "Is this not Joseph's son?" or by the religious leaders. Jesus was a threat to the existing perceptions of the Messiah as a person of power and riches, who would free the Jewish people from the oppression of the Roman occupying forces. Jesus hardly fit the bill of a Messiah as an itinerant preacher coming from Nazareth and poor as a church, (synagogue), poor as a church mouse. His homeboys regarded him as a blasphemer and certainly one who could not be believed. Angered by their lack of belief, Jesus said to them, "Truly, I tell you, no prophet is accepted in his hometown." That's Luke 4:24, Matthew 13:57, Mark 6:4. So the rejection of Jesus in his hometown would be a precursor of many rejections in his future ministry. While he marveled because of their unbelief, Jesus did not hesitate to preach that the kingdom of God was at hand and it was time to repent. In instructing his disciples in their preaching, Jesus told them, "If anyone will not welcome you or listen to you, leave that home and town and shake the dust off from your feet and move on." The practicality of Jesus' advice to keep the truth foremost in mind when preaching remains a contemporary challenge for all of us. Rather than get bogged down with those who refuse to believe, the disciples were encouraged to trust in the providential care of God, and like Jesus, when he got booted out of Nazareth, dust off their feet and move on to those interested in hearing the truth. Commissioning his disciples to preach the truth, Jesus inaugurated a band of whistleblowers who would risk sharing in his passion, death, and resurrection. Preaching a gospel based on justice and peace will pose an ongoing threat to powerful institutions which are more interested in maintaining injustice than war. Truth tellers and whistleblowers are kindred spirits living in a dangerous world. Perhaps it would be too simplistic to assume, as did St. Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians, 12, verse 31, and 13, verses 18, that all the problems of the world could be solved if we just learned to love one another. Paul, who got run out of town on more than one occasion and spent half his ministry in jail, was no stranger to cynical threats. As a true follower of Jesus and unflagging whistleblower who never surrendered his pursuit of the truth of the gospel, Paul firmly believed, "If I speak in the tongues of human beings but do not have love," which is equal, you know, truth in parentheses, love and truth, "I am but a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal." Paul's eloquent description of love as patient and kind is based upon the fact that love always rejoices in the truth. So without judgment or condescension, Paul, like Jesus, remained a steadfast whistleblower for the truth. So refocusing our eyes of faith, we must rediscover the truth of Jesus as the fulfillment of the messianic promise. Perhaps Pope Francis, in inaugurating the Year of Mercy, has become the most prominent whistleblower in the church and the world, as he focuses on the needs of the poor, the anawim, irritating so many entrenched clerics in the church with his invitations to relinquish unmerciful man-made laws. He has liberated the captives and set free those who have been imprisoned in shame and guilt. In this recent visit to the United States, Israel, Latin America, and so many other parts of the world, Pope Francis has continually challenged world powers and institutions to take care of the poor and the planet. Rising above the din of negative critiques, Francis, like Jesus, remains steadfast in his pursuit of truth. Again, I must say, personally, I don't know. I haven't followed Pope Francis. Obviously, this author has his opinion. That's for each to, you know, investigate. But I think some of the words of this article are very factual and well put, and they get the clear message of where the truth lies. So I didn't have much time to prepare because of an emergency today, so please forgive me if I'm relying on reading script. But again, when somebody puts a lot of time and places their words carefully and credibly, I think it's worth repeating them word for word. So the question is, can you hear the whistle blowing? Worry not for whom the whistle blows. It blows for you and me. And I'm going to share a personal experience. I have been working with Extinction Rebellion. The title Extinction Rebellion captured my attention. The headlines from England that shutting down railways or roadways was very powerful. It sparked global challenges to the fossil fuel fiesta, so to speak. But as the climate engineering topic that I cited from the beginning, that's been overlooked, even by this group, Extinction Rebellion. Yes, indeed, there are some within that movement that acknowledge climate engineering, but there's no kind of momentum to bring it to the fore, to the forefront. As in my opinion, it's the fundamental big puzzle piece that can really get progress rolling if people only knew it was there, or if people only acknowledged it was there. So, you know, there's many barriers, fear and comfort being that when, you know, institutionalized, highly intelligent people are in their own field of expertise, it's as if they're too proud to admit that anything else outside of their field is important. And whereas the person of great scholarly achievement versus, say, a farmer out in the field who looks up in the sky, that farmer has more wisdom than the intelligent person. You know, that's an easy way to put it. That's something that Dane Wigington, the author of Geoengineering Watch, has shared. I think that's a great example. So, personal end of it, I've attended meetings, I've written letters, I've spoken to people, and it set me off on Saturday because on the way to the meeting, I noticed the sky just covered with jet sprayed aerosol dispersions, aerosol trails. Again, the mainstream media, the establishment calls what we see in the sky condensation trails. That the idea of aerosols is just some proposal down the road if we need to do it. The biggest lie, in my opinion, ever perpetrated on humanity. Because indeed, this is global. There's photos throughout the world, everywhere, of these lines in the sky that persist and become clouds. And it takes particles to do so. So at this meeting, I patiently listened to somebody talk about their cause, which was furs, you know, preventing fur trapping and so forth, which, you know, fine. I have nothing, no problem with all these individuals. The meeting before, it was somebody talking about soils. It was a garden center, the, you know, compost and all these wonderful things people can do. I'm, you know, 100% behind these. But it seems whenever I bring up such a large topic that deals with national security, that, you know, the perception is we can't touch that. But twice I've heard the same response. From the first day I participated in an action with Extinction Rebellion, it was crossing the bridge in Minneapolis and having kind of a mourning session about the sadness of what we're losing in this planet. It was a very good, well-planned event with a bicycle ride through town with, you know, showing our Extinction Rebellion signs and logos. But I remember approaching a woman and saying, you know, I have a poem I've written and I just like to share it because it expresses so much, you know, in a profound way what I feel we need to know related to climate engineering. And she said, you know, that's too painful. I don't want to hear it. So what is it? 5 months later, I get to this meeting and I finally kind of lose patience and I, you know, I have to go and I say, well, I want to let you all know outside, if you look up, there's aerosol trails. And I think it's very important for all of us to know and rally behind this global issue and the fact that Minnesota has a federal lawsuit to get disclosure on this issue. Whether or not you believe it's true, I can. There's no doubt that if all these planes are in the sky, it's proven already that they're not. They're mostly not commercial planes. There's many ways to prove it. There's articles that show that non-commercial jets are the chief increase in jet fuel, not commercial. So this, as I was handing out this fact photo sheet, the woman pushed it back to me and she said, this is too painful. So, you know, it sent a spark in me. It's like I heard this same thing when I began this and I'm hearing the same thing 5 months later. That was enough. So that was helpful for me. That made my decision clear, is just to drop ties. And sadly, my egoic mind, I lost it. But you can't hold in emotions either. At some point, you have to express them. Otherwise, you get depressed. It's anger turned inward leads to depression. So I vented some, and I kind of said, well, I regret a couple things I said, I made clear. But I did write a letter, and I expressed that you are welcome to contact me. I'll remind you, you can find information if you're interested on geoengineeringwatch.org. But what a relief. How good it feels now to be done with that and have more clarity in where I'm going. How good it feels not to be involved with Metro State University, trying to get in as a student into their program so I can get on campuses. You know, if you get a dead end, big deal. As was said by Jesus to his disciples, when you get dead ends, don't worry about it. Dust it off and go on. Identify your support and go on. And how exciting it is to have visited libraries with my display and knowing I may get maybe up to 6 or 7 people interested out of maybe a couple hundred that go by or 100. That's outstanding because already I found a military veteran that is more than excited to get involved with this issue as I revealed it to him. And I found people at the Rondo Library more than interested. I've been able to get some names and so forth. And anyone listening, I welcome you to contact me or Brother Job or Sister Rhea. I'm doing everything possible now to arrange an Earth Day event and how I'd love to speak at it. And I think I do have a chance because the Minnesota federal lawsuit is a Freedom of Information Act. And I've made very clear, you know, this is a topic that I think is important. So we'll see if I get allowed. But on the other hand, as a nonprofit organization, I'm anticipating either Wednesday, April 22, Earth Day, or the following Saturday, or, you know, the Saturday after Earth Day, there's also a big Earth Week-related event. So we'll see what happens. So I'll keep people in touch with the next blog as to the progress on that. But again, as we're in a time-lapse collapse of the biosphere, in my opinion, and many share that opinion, and, you know, the people in Extinction Rebellion also share that opinion. It's just that what is the solution? The stopping climate engineering would get the wheels rolling. And it's got to happen fast, in my opinion. It seems that if we're so resistant to this so-called empire, using weather as weather warfare, using bacteria or virus as biological warfare, and at the same time having the hypocrisy to point at nature as the fault of these things, yet acknowledging, yes, the fossil fuel fiesta is part of it, the big part of it, but, you know, it's such a half-truth, and a half-truth is a lie. Because if fossil fuels are just a part of it and nature's the rest of it, oh, I'm sorry. This, as in my poem I stated last week, only the willing can see human-caused extinction. If you really investigate the facts, it's pretty much all on one species. And it is a biological law, a natural law of life, that any species that destroys other species to increase its food supply, to increase its population. Well, when you lose the web of life and all the species that support and enable your food supply, then at some point it's going to crash. And sadly, that's what's happening. But I take solace that all we can do is do what's in our own control. And if Extinction Rebellion, for example, is not in my control or an event doesn't happen, it's not to get discouraged. It's just to keep finding those alternative ways to get and do your best. There's nothing more. So with that, I want to go on a little further to some of the website recent discussions by Dane Wigington. And I'll go back a little further. So he connects the most important dots in his hour-long blog a couple weeks ago. And basically, it all relates to food, whether it's this bacteria, this virus, or whether it's climate engineering, which, you know, underneath it all, even without the virus, as Dane says, alone is an emergency that we must acknowledge. So what are examples of food? The Australian drought, locusts in Sudan, Black Death. RiceFarmerBlogspot.com, you know, makes mention of this. Low-intensity wars, energy decline, so scrambling for energy resources, a rapid failing of the global economy, which happens at this moment. And so the virus just aggravates existing problems. And indeed, you know, the stock market, it was a reason for the stock market to fall. The stock market was needed a reason to fall. And Dane talks about the SARS and MERS, designer viruses of the past with all the biological labs. I neglected to mention the Project Cloverleaf. Now this is, I'm trying to think, the Tuskegee experiment was even before. So that's the prelude to this whole topic. It starts with Tuskegee. Yes, there were other evil things before, but that's kind of the beginning of it all. And later, after World War II, was Project Cloverleaf. Again, the same thing. There was like 2,000 Nazi scientists recruited to the United States. You can look it up. Project Cloverleaf, look it up in Wikipedia. What an amazing piece of information, because they're admitting the existence of biolabs. And the one where Lyme's disease came out, it was at Lyme Island. You know, one can look it up, but a famous German scientist during World War II had experimented with spreading bacteria, I believe it was, with ticks as a means of biological warfare. And biological labs are known to have many leaks. And it's very well, very likely, very compelling evidence, at least, that, you know, in the lab in, I think it was the New York area where Lyme's disease originated, it was in an island or something like that, and an animal got it, who knows? But the point of it is the tick experiments for Lyme disease very, very likely, in my opinion, originated from a biological lab. So even if it didn't, the existence of biological labs all over the planet is no doubt there. And Dr. Boyle came to mind, and I'll save that for a little later. I just wanted to get through with Mr. Wigington and his response from the climate engineering point of view. And then I'll probably end it with Dr. Boyle, as I've intended to do. Just quickly, Dr. Boyle, Francis Boyle, was the one that wrote the 1989 legislation that was passed with bipartisan support. Just to review. Massive support to stop biological warfare. So these things that are happening and can be proven with the paper trail are, you know, all those documents point to the fact that this illegal action continues and proliferates, and it has to be stopped. But so Dane was saying the equation could not be more than nonlinear at this point in time. The feedback loops, methane tripling, quadrupling, putting more heat on the planet. And then you have leaders from another empire, like, but Putin states there's no connection to between human activity and climate change. RTTV denies this. You know, there's some very strong truths in RTTV that I believe are true, but, you know, even alternative press has their falsehoods. And a point, people profit off coronavirus, as did Al Gore with his warning about global warming. You know, the idea of trade credits was just a mockery. It enabled a lot of trade wealth to basically mask that the problem was exponentially worse than Al Gore said it was. So does that mean these things are not real? Just like banks profit off war, does that mean it didn't happen? That's, I think, a well-pointed thing. So Earth Life Support Systems have paid ever so dearly for the USA dream, and other nations have emulated lifestyle of mass consumption. Governments, state-sponsored mafia, planetary omnicide on the current course, elected officials and appointees are public face of the behind-the-curtain people, those that hide in the shadows, shadow government, so to speak, and then the deep state, which is the greed and power of corporations, whereas the shadow government is, you know, fear and intimidation, rule by fear and intimidation. So those pulling the strings, they're bidding. The power structure, total desperation is manifesting, controlling and or culling priority. So we have to awaken to these plans. You know, the military, if they're awakened, our brothers and sisters who go in with honorable intentions, but if they're not waking up to what they're doing in this compartmentalized, no ID, you're just a number kind of culture, it takes the public to help awaken them to what they're doing to their own families when they're spraying the skies, for example. So, you know, I guess, as I said, in a library I met a veteran, and he's excited to spread with his brothers and sisters, you know, the news of how dangerous climate engineering is. So the paradigm would shift. So what will it take? Fabricated promise of freedom and democracy? Only things spread with freedom and democracy as it's been is carnage and chaos in pursuit of empire. So militaries, how long? The aerosol assault. Military people must remember their oaths to protect us. You didn't take an oath to blindly and unquestioningly serve the dictates of empire. All governments are criminal, and can a belief or belief system ever be a just substitute for an honest and unbiased investigation? So if you're coming in with good intentions, you're responsible to raise questions while you're there, as did Matt Tillman, as did Kristen Megan. Again, a reminder of Kristen Megan. She was an industrial hygienist. After 9/11, she entered. She started inquiring about the use of chemicals that she understood from the data log, that they didn't belong, that they were way in excess. And she was booted out of two military camps, or how should I say, bases, and said she needed psychological testing. Her daughter was threatened, and so forth and so on. So it's sad that, you know, if one speaks out, you're at risk. But at the same time, if you gather enough people, you're at less risk. And there's a saying by Mark Twain somewhere, if I can find it. And I like this saying. It says, in the beginning of change, the patriot is brave and scarce, hated and scorned. But in the end, when his cause succeeds, the timid join him. It costs nothing to be a patriot. That's quite profound. Another saying by Dane, that Dane Wigington cited, from Maya Angelou. Courage is the most important of all virtues, because without courage, we can't practice any other virtue consistently. And then, as Dane says, free will is a gift. It's our own. It can't be taken, ever. So, you know, what we choose is our own. And let me switch back now, if I can wake up the computer. I'm going to try to find, I want to talk about Dr. Boyle a little bit, because I want to conclude with the paper trail. And for some reason, my computer isn't working, so I'll remember the best I can. But he's been blocked by mainstream media. He had an interview on InfoWars, which is, you know, called a conspiracy channel. And here is some, I found it now. And what time do I have? I have a few minutes, so good. I can wrap it up with this. So I have the interview in front of me, so it's accurate. I didn't scribble it in my notes. So Dr. Boyle says that it's correct that the Nat Med, that's it. Now, if you look through this carefully, first notice who was involved in this DNA genetic engineering of SARS, which is already a biological warfare agent to give it gain of function activities. Gain of function activities means that in human beings, this is the type of virus that can be lethal or it can spread easily. That's what you call gain of function. So, and it has, and all these people there from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, it has someone from the Food and Drug Administration. So you can't trust the Food and Drug Administration. And then at the very bottom of the list, who is involved? Zhengli Li Shai, key laboratory of special pathogens and biosafety at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, Chinese Academy of Sciences, Wuhan, China. So it's very clear to me that this scientist from Wuhan Institute of Virology got this gain-of-function technology for SARS from the University of North Carolina lab. And he didn't steal it, or she didn't steal it. What happened, so I guess he's not sure if it was a male or female, but he's got the name. What happened was, if you read carefully to the end of the article acknowledgments, they acknowledge a national Natural Science Foundation of China Award. In other words, the Chinese government paid them to have one of their top biological warfare experts involved in this type of thing. So Alex interrupts, he's the interviewer, and he's reading the paper. So I'm just going to go down a little bit. I'm just going to go to the highlighted portions because I'm running out of time. Dr. Boyle says, these best scientists at the University of North Carolina took dirty money from China to allow that one of their top biowarfare experts from this Wuhan Institute of Virology in Wuhan, which has the BSL-4, that's the top level safety facility that they can use for biowarfare or lab development. They knew exactly what they were doing. And they permitted this Chinese scientist to work with them to give gain of function biowarfare DNA genetic capability to SARS. SARS is a type of coronaviruses. So he's got the smoking gun. And I'm going to jump down to see if I can find the articles. And maybe I've already gone past it. So here's another bold print. Their new DNA genetically engineered virus constitutes a gain in pathogenesis. That is a gain of function right there. They admit it. Pathogenesis means lethality and infectiousness. And we know that even The Lancet has said lethality is about 15%. If you disaggregate numbers even put out by the Chinese government, it's about 17%. So I've heard, you know, anywhere from 3 to 17%, but compared to the normal flu, the lethality of this virus is 30 times. You know, if it's at 3%, it's 30 times the lethality of your normal flu bug. I'm trying to find that article because that's the paper trail that, you know, clearly documents the facts. I do understand that there's been cooperation by a Canadian biological lab, also an Australian biological lab. The money trail can be traced as well. So let me get into some non-bold print here. So you remember in our previous interview, you had asked me if this had come out of the BSL-4 facility in Winnipeg, Canada, was stolen out there. I said that that could have happened. Winnipeg is our equivalent of Fort Detrick. That's one of our main biological labs in the United States. They do every type of hideous, offensive Nazi-type biological warfare work up there you can possibly imagine. But again, on the basis of materials, scientific materials, I had a chance to read over the weekend, I have changed my opinion. I think that I have definitive evidence where this came from, and it came from, you know, the University of North Carolina. So I have condemned them before because they have done gain-function work. Again, this man wrote the legislation to prevent gain-function work. So the DNA genetic engineering on every hideous biological warfare agent you can imagine, including MERS, at the time was called the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome Agent. That's the same thing as MERS, which again is a biowarfare coronavirus. And more about the university. Again, I wish I could wrap up things a little more smoothly, but it's getting close to time to close, time for me to go to work and do what I have to do. But there was an article, and I'll have it next time around if I can't find it within the next minute or two. But I just can't seem to find it. So Dr. Francis Boyle wrote the U.S. Biological Weapons Law. I've already said that. And I can read the reports. It's ridiculous how obvious that the Chinese paid a U.S. university. That's Wall Street Journal, New York Times, for Chinese communist funding. So for whatever reason, we're better at science than they are, and they're getting us to finance. And one of the reasons Dr. Boyle had a theory that China would want help from us is perhaps they were going after Taiwan with biological warfare. You know, what are the reasons? We just can't know. There's the theory that the United States did this, some kind of CIA covert operation to punish China. Whereas Dr. Boyle, to the best of his knowledge, knows that things leak. He thinks it's likely that one of the scientists at the lab just, it's so easy, even in spite of the most precautions, if they get this virus and they're walking out in public, it's going to go bonkers because it's got that functional gain that we're talking about. And it's kind of interesting. It's a chimeric virus. So, again, as I understand, Australia helped with this. I believe there was like 4 inserts to this virus that Indian scientists have confirmed and French scientists have confirmed. You know, from the paper trail, these viruses are well known. So any changes when they get the patients and do the testing, they can see the difference in the genetic makeup. I got to close. If you can still hear me, my phone is about to run out of energy. So thank you for your time. It's 4:00, and I will come back with that article next time. And I look forward 2 weeks from now for my next blog. Thank you so much.
Thank you.